In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Betches Media presents Betches Moms, with hosts Aileen Drexler and Brittany Levine. Get ready to lock yourself in the bathroom or wherever else you hide from your kids, because you'll literally never be alone again.
Hello and welcome to the Betches Moms podcast. I'm Aileen, as you guys know, and today we are joined by two-time author whose book Father Figure, How to Be a Feminist Dad just came out, and our first dad on this podcast, Jordan Shapiro. Welcome, Jordan.
Thank you for inviting me. It is kind of super exciting to be the first dad on here. It's like a real achievement.
Just kind of super excited.
Just kind of. Yeah.
It is an achievement. I'm really excited to hear your perspective. The title of your book is very intriguing. But before we get into all of that, so you're a dad.
I am. Yeah.
Yeah. You're a father. So how many kids do you have? How old are they? What's the context of all
this? What's the context? Well, I have two kids and two stepkids, and I don't even know how old they are. They're like annoying teenagers. They're like, they range from like 12 to 16. They're all mixed together. So the ones that are my birth children are 16 and 14, and the other ones I think are 15 and 12. There's so many birthdays to her. I know what dates they are, and I bake That's the good. Cakes and all. I just don't care what age they are. You know, do you ever notice kids when they're really little, they like compete over that as if they did something? They're like, well, I'm 4 and a half. My birthday's before yours.
I don't know. I'm about to have my first kid, so we're going to find
sorry.
Out.
I'm so sorry.
That's okay, but you're making a good case for father figure. I don't know how old my kids are, you know, teens at some age. But that's a lot. That's a lot of teenage, almost teenage, preteen kids, handful.
Absolutely, it is a handful, and you know, in some ways, as they get older, it gets easier, and in some ways, as it gets older, it gets harder. You know, the hardest sort of exhausting work is definitely when kids are really, really little. But I think the harder mental work comes as they start to get old enough to challenge you and argue right. with you, and you have to think of like, you know, with little kids, you just say stop, and they like, okay, I want to please you, Dad, right?
Yeah, they still love you.
Older kids, you say stop, and they're like, can we debate the reason why you think maybe I should stop?
it definitely challenges your reasoning for your reason for why you're telling them to do what you want them to do. I mean, also when they're younger, you sort of, I don't know, you kind of, you're not as scared to mess them up as when they're a little bit older, right? I'm assuming.
Oh, I don't know if that's true. I mean, I think it depends what you mean.
all sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is like, I guess you're a lot, when they were really young, lots of like health scares, really like not relaxed about that. You know, it's like, I don't know if it's that sound is healthy. I don't know. Oh, is it possible?
From a parenting perspective, like your reactions, they might remember like 15 years later, but when they're really little,
I hope that's not true because, you know, I was much more patient when they were little. it's much more frustrating to deal with, you know, 13-year-olds who really don't know very much at all, but don't believe you know anything either. So,
yeah. Right. Oh my God. I can't even wrap my brain around that. It's weird to think about that when I can remember myself as a 13-year-old, 10-year-old, and like what I thought of my parents It's like a really weird, I mean, I'm literally about to have, we were supposed to record last Friday,
but really?
I got stuck at my OB. Yeah. And I was like, I'm so sorry. Hopefully he understands. I'm 38 weeks pregnant.
I didn't get all those details, but I still understood.
Okay. Well, now you understand. So I'm like, all of those kind of emotions or those thoughts are going through my head and just like thinking about, you know, how you're talking about your kids' ages. And just, I can remember myself as this age. How is that possible that's about to happen?
It's nuts. And it's also definitely a wake up call. You sort of, I mean, this first happened when I first started teaching in a university undergrads. And I suddenly realized, whoa, I wasn't nearly as old when I was 20 as I thought I was. I wasn't nearly as mature as I thought I was. And now I watch teenagers and it's the sort of the right. same thing. You sort of remember those fights you had with your parents where you were sure you were so smart. And now I'm like, whoa, I must have been just like that.
Right. Only probably
that's
dumber.
True. That's true. Absolutely. I do think that that today's kids are much smarter or at least more sophisticated because they have a lot more access to ideas than previous generations.
For sure. Well, let's talk about your book. Okay. So the premise is that when it comes to books about parenting identity, a lot of it centers around motherhood, but yours is about fathers and dads. So can you tell us about like why you wrote it and how, and what is it about? What would I get from it, from reading it?
I like how you phrased the question, right? Because the part you just said about like when it comes to books about mom, parenting identity, they're all about moms. I mean, someone at the publisher wrote that and I like it. but it was a really tough thing because I think I was really writing a book that didn't fit into categories. So it becomes, how do you make it make sense to people what they're going to pick up? You know, I didn't want people to pick it up and think it was a how-to book for dads, because it's certainly not like, you know, there's nothing in this book like what's the right way to compliment your daughter, right? Which I think a lot of people assume when they see it, it's going to be about like don't compliment your daughter's looks, compliment her brains, right? And there's nothing that simple in it. But it's very much about how dads need to change the way they think about themselves and the way that they move through the world and frame the world and the family and the way they think about their relationship with their children. So in that sense, we said it was about identity because a lot of it's about how we think about what dad is, right? What it means to be a dad, what it means to be a father, what it even in some ways even what it means to be a husband. Although I only kind of peripherally touch on that. And what that looks like in the current world, you know, and this is where the book starts to get complicated because father, of course, is a inherently gendered term. Right. And I wanted to write a book that was really, really inclusive and wasn't sort of cis heteronormative in the way that it talked about these questions. So it was more a book for how do you take people who want to identify as cis heteronormative dads and give them the tools they need to make sense of a world that is thinking about gender and sexuality and relationships and sex in such different ways than everything they've ever been taught.
Yeah. Well, so what does it mean to be a dad?
Right. Yeah, that's what it really is the question. What does it mean to be a dad?
Yeah.
We called it, what does it mean to be a feminist dad or how to be a feminist dad? Mostly because we wanted people to know that this was really a book about thinking about how dad fits into a new ethos of gender thinking. You know, when I started to write the book, I thought I was going to write sort of a Jungian archetypal book, like what's the core dad archetype and what's the father archetype across all of history and multiculturally everywhere. I very quickly found out that there wasn't much of a good argument to make there. And that although there are lots of images of dad, there's really no good argument for gendered parenting at all. And I don't mean you shouldn't be a gender while you parent. I mean, do whatever you want while you parent. Yeah. I just mean the idea that men parent in a specific way and women parent in another specific way. While those things may be common because they've become the norms that we're used to. And so we enact those roles. There's no good biological argument for why dads would, for example, be the tough love parent and moms would be the nurturer, right? Yeah. There's no, you know, that's all nonsense. That's all sexist nonsense. And in many cases used to maintain really problematic power structures.
So then what about, so then forget the language of like dad, mom, like the person in the relationship, say one is the birth person. are we going, it is different, I'm assuming, right? To be a different type of parent when you're the non-birth parent.
You mean the parent, you mean the parent
didn't physically carried.
Yeah.
Or birth the kid.
Well, it is, and it isn't. Of course, it is different, right? I mean, anything's different, right? I mean, I don't want to pretend that difference doesn't exist. That would be absurd. Yeah. but many of the things that we associate with those differences or take to be sort of facts are really myths. This idea. So I'll give you a few examples. You know, one is we for a long time have said that because women carry babies, they have an inherently like almost spiritual bond with the infant child that's that transcends anything rational. It's magical. It's like, right. And this has often been used as actually a way to make moms have to do more work, right? Because they feel like they're not being good moms if they're not, if they're not feeling it. So then they try to enact this thing to try to feel it and be like, wow, there is a special supernatural bond. One that doesn't necessarily exist. It might, I mean, in individuals, but there's no science that shows that like every mom has a different relationship. In fact, there's lots of cases where the father ends up having a much closer, and by father I mean in the terms that we currently talk, I shouldn't say currently, the terms people often talk about it in, right? Cisgender terms, that the father is inherently, you know, it's a Freudian idea that their job is to separate the infant from the mother, you know, this sort of ongoing weaning, because the baby wants so much nurturing and we need dad to teach them how to be tough and to give a sense of the real world's apathy, right? But there's no science saying there's anything male about that is something that I think all kids need in some ways, but the idea that it needs to come from one parent or the other is problematic. I mean, we can go through all these things. You can ask a million questions about this if you want. And I would also just say, one of the things that I found really interesting is that there are quite a few biological changes that happen to men while the baby is in your belly. So there's hormonal changes, there's neurological changes, there's all different kinds of symptoms, you know, trouble sleeping, changes in what they eat. Now, the question is, nobody can really prove whether or not that's because of the baby or because of the spouse, right? So it could be a reaction.
Where does the anxiety come from?
Right. It could be because they're just sort of mimicking their partner. But nobody really knows. And in some like indigenous cultures that we have research from going back hundreds of years. And I shouldn't say that research goes back hundreds of years. The research is from hundreds of years ago. There were indigenous cultures that no longer exist that were very much had sort of rituals where the husband actually had to just like sit there for 9 months and not do anything, so they would experience a similar thing to what their wife was experiencing, and all kinds of rituals to acknowledge that there were changes. Again, what I don't want anyone to think is that I'm saying, you know, men have it tough too during pregnancy. I'm certainly not saying any of that. I'm just saying that there's that those post pregnancy questions where we believe that there's a gender difference in how they're going to interact with the kid. There's really not any good research to back that up.
About to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
So what do you propose then in the book that needs to change? Like, what exactly are you saying should it mean to be a feminist dad?
Well, the first thing it means to be a feminist dad is to be willing to, in the book, I call it critical consciousness, which is a term I stole from the Brazilian educator, Paulo Freire. It's about acknowledging how you participate in systems that are inherently sexist or inherently impressive or inherently problematic. And so all these things you and I were just talking about, these sort of taken for granted ideas like moms are always going to be the nurturer and dads are always going to be the tough love parent. Well, what happens is we end up living into those narratives, and then we end up teaching kids to still believe gender essentialist narratives about what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman, right? We end up, the more that fathers end up playing the roles that sort of match the 1950s sitcom dad, the more we create a world where those stereotypes are taken for granted by kids. You know, kids grow up, as we were just saying, you grow up and you sort of mimic the things that you saw in your own household, even when you try not to. I mean, I'll tell you right now, you haven't had the baby yet, but you'll do all these things to try to not be anything like your parents, all the things you remember. Then the first time they fall down the steps and you're terrified, you just immediately, like, I remember that day, the day I'm like, oh my God, that was my father's voice. It came out. I had tried so hard, but when I was scared, there was no more trying hard. Instantly mimic what I saw growing up. I was lucky. What I saw growing up was really a positive model, not without problems, but not perfect either. Not without problems means not perfect, right? Not, but great and also problematic at the same time. But the more we see, the more we imitate it, the more we end up modeling for our kids a sense of gendered divisions and gender binaries that end up with problematic attitudes. So, you know, one of the obvious examples here is if you think about the distribution of household labor. So there have been a million studies that have shown this, even in families with the most progressive dads in people who would claim to be so, I should say in history, because actually dads do spend more time at home doing childcare than ever before in human history, or at least in recorded human history. But even in those places with fathers like me, that would be like, I'm a proudly progressive feminist dad. I wanted everything to be equal. When they do real studies of the labor in the household, they see that very little has changed, right? And that's even in households where the mother is the primary breadwinner. She's still doing a disproportionate amount of the labor. So what does that show kids? If you imagine teenagers, you don't even have to go to teenagers. If you think of 7-year-olds and 5-year-olds and 6-year-olds who start to play by imitating the vacuuming, right? Well, are they imitating the dad vacuuming or are they imitating the mom vacuuming? How are they starting to make up ideas about how the world is organized? And so when I say be a feminist dad, it's time for us to really ask these questions as men, right? And it's our job, because women have been doing it for a long time now. Now we have to step up and be willing to say, hey, we want to model a different version of gender equity for our children.
Right. So I know you said it's not a how-to. So, but like, what, for people listening, mostly women who are then going to tell their partners, what practical things that maybe, do you share any practical tips that like father figures, quote, can do to reverse the stereotypes or like,
I do some. It's sort of a mix. Some of it's practical, but the larger question is that most people, this is not a book to tell you how to be, right? This is not a book to say, I know what's the best way for you to be a dad. That would, mm-hmm. not only would that be absurd, that would also be like, really, no dad is, you know, they don't don't even ask for directions when they're driving. So they're certainly not going to ask for directions on how to be a dad, right? So nobody would read it. But this is a book on how do you, that gives you the tools for how to ask yourself questions about your own behavior so that you can make decisions that are better for you. So we were just talking about the division of household labor. I often tell people that's the first place to start with your partner is go, let's talk about household labor for a second. Let's make sure we haven't divided our chores according to genitals, right? did we divide? Because there's not, believe me, I mean, I do a lot of laundry. Pretty sure there's nothing about a penis or vagina that has anything to do with doing laundry. Also, it's not even hard, right? It's like you pour some soap in and press the button, right? The idea of someone being good at it is always been crazy to me.
That's my argument to my husband, though. You're really good at it. Just keep going.
Well, right. Whoever's better at it should be the one who does it. But so many of the things we do in our households are still based on genitals and it, for no reason, right? Like ask, sit down and go, let's think of all the things we have to do on a daily basis. Who's doing it and why? Often we're letting, you know, moms do what many people call Eve Rodsky has a great book about this. She calls it the she-fault parent instead of default. And the idea that moms end up responsible for all the sort of emotional, intellectual, logistic labor, right? They have to think about when's the next pediatrician's appointment. They have to plan the birthday parties. They have to think about planning the birthday parties. They have to think, you know, it's all the mental work going on in the background of everything. Moms end up responsible for. And then dads are like, after mom says, will you pick up the groceries? They're like, sure, I'm happy to help. But mom had to first think of all the groceries that were needed, right? Mom had to first think about, you know, there is soccer practice. Yeah, dad might pick the kid up from soccer practice, but are they really tracking the schedule, for example, right? A lot of that is just all falls on the mom. So I think what I suggest to most families is go try to imagine all of those things and really divvy them up according to who's better at it. In many cases, it doesn't even make sense because you have the parent who stinks at it doing it, right?
Who enjoys doing it maybe too.
Yeah, I mean, enjoys is a good thing. I mean, I think people should do it if they enjoy it, but we also have been, you know, this is where we start to get into real sexism, right? If you live in a world where everything on television has told you that you're supposed to enjoy it. Supernatural love of your children that makes you want to fold their laundry and clean their asses.
I'll take it back.
Then you think you like it, right? In fact, you have to say you like it or else you think you're a bad woman.
Right. No, I mean, that is true. Okay. I mean, I think you're saying make like at least maybe like make a business meeting with your with your partner and divvy up like what, why am I doing this? You should be doing this or take who should be the person taking responsibility.
We keep score in my family. My partner Amanda and I, we have a whiteboard and we keep score. Like that keeps it also a little bit light. Like we joke about it and like we have a scoreboard and we're like we argue about who gets points for what. I get a lot of points if I like go to like dinner with her parents or her sisters and she gets points if she goes to dinner with my parents and my brothers. But then we also who did the vacuuming, who swept the floors, and we keep track.
It's called gold stars.
Yeah. And like we get all the, I mean, this is where I think that there's some like covert, like sinister stuff in the patriarchy is like we get all this messaging that's like you shouldn't keep score in relationships. But we all know if you don't keep score in relationships, it's going to lean towards the man, right? Everything's organized so the man's going to get more points unless you're actually keeping score. So I'm all for it. I keep score and I try to win and it becomes super competitive. And, you know, if you want, I guess there's lots of ways you can manage like what you get if you get more points. You could just, it could be pride. It could, you know, you could divvy that up in the bedroom, what you do with the points. I don't know. However you want to do it, that's fine. But I think it's a great thing. And anyone who has a company should know this, right? What you make a budget line for actually has value. And what we often do in our families is pretend that most of what we think of as women's work has no value. We don't mention it. We don't see it. We don't draw that budget line for it. So draw the budget line for it.
Right. Like recognize at least. So maybe your partner could also, where you can recognize each other's, what you do for the family.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'm not suggesting we need to change those roles necessarily. I mean, I'm all for changing some of them. In my house, I do all the cooking. Mostly it's because I was a professional chef for years, so I can do it with a lot more ease. It doesn't mean I want
perhaps
to do
you
it
enjoy
all the time.
It.
there's a long history of unhappiness around it, but it doesn't matter. It takes me, you know, we have six people in the household. It's really easy for me to cook for six people because I used to cook for 600 people all the time, and I do that with ease. So it makes sense for me to take that on. But you don't have to do that. I'm not trying to say men need to do all the cooking. What I'm trying to say is you need to tally everything up so that you start to recognize the value. The biggest problem, I think, in families, the things that lead to the fighting, and this is, I know you have mostly women listening, but I wish you had men, because the things that lead to a fighting, the reason she's mad at you is because you're not recognizing how much work she's doing. That's it. Right. Just recognizing it would solve so many things. Just willing to talk about the fact that you understand that there are, you know, patriarchal, cultural things that make it harder to be a woman. It doesn't mean you have to do, you know, this is not like, oh, you're an evil man. There's no part of my book that's about accusing you. It's just going, hey, I recognize that there are injustices here. I'll do what I can to use my privilege to fix them. I'm obviously not the solution by myself.
Yeah. I love that take. I'm sure the people listening might just tell their partners what you've just said.
Well, they should buy the book Father Figure as a gift. That's the way to do it. Just leave it on the bedside table and, you know,
But as we all know, we need to make them come to that idea themselves to buy the book, to want to read the book.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Lolly Focus Pops or Lolly Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
I want to talk about technology because in your first book, The New Childhood, you talk about technology and how kids and parents should embrace it, which is an interesting take because a lot of people, any parenting blogs or whatever, they're like, how to minimize technology. So how did you come up with this, you know, idea, and why? What's the thesis here?
I am so glad. I'm so actually really glad you're asking this because you're doing it. 38 weeks is the perfect time to be asking this question. Most people ask me and I'm like, you're too late. You already screwed up. But you've got it right. Okay. First thing is, okay, what is it called? The American Association of Pediatrics or American Pediatrics, whichever one it is.
Sounds
AAP,
right.
I think. Yeah. Yeah. So they say avoid screens for kids under three. Okay. I'm completely in line with this, but I want to add some caveats here. One, kids are going to see enough screens no matter what, and there's nothing wrong with screens. So you don't have to give them any video games. You know, like there's nothing toxic. It's not going to give them brain damage. They're going to see the TV occasionally because you're going to be playing with them while it's on. They're going to see your phone sometimes. You can't even go to a gas station anymore without the TV like playing right
on
the pump, right? So they're going to have enough screens without you having them any extra. That being said, when you have a newborn, and you will soon, it is impossible. Like, you have no time to shower. There is nothing wrong with handing the kid an iPad and taking a shower and letting them watch a YouTube video so they'll shut up for like 10 minutes so that you can like have a shower. In fact, I'd argue it's probably better than you being tired and not showered, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to hurt the kid. But what you don't want for little kids is for them to be watching videos, staring at a screen all day long. And that's not because the screen is dangerous. That's because they need what's called a serve and return interactions with adults. They need eye contact. They need you to say things like, do you want a cookie? Do you like cookies? You know, like have the conversations that teach them language, that teach them interaction, that teach them social skills. And what the AAP is really afraid of is that if they were to say, you know, note that screens aren't toxic, which we know and parents who are tired are just going to leave the kid in front of a screen all day, and they're going to lose all those positive, not just positive, essential parts of development. So as long as you're doing lots of face-to-face talk with your kid, you know, a little bit of screen's not going to hurt. As they get older, this is where I think we have a real problem, because we're actually not introducing enough of the screen at the ages above three to teenager. Okay.
Hot take. Okay.
and the reason I say this is what we were saying earlier. Teenagers, the average age we give kids phones and tablets now, I think when I wrote the book, it was 12. It's probably gone younger now, but I mean of their own, not just let them use it, but like they have their own phone or their own iPad. My guess is it's younger now. But this never made sense to me, right? I was just telling you, teenagers don't listen to you. You can't set boundaries for teenagers. Like, it's already done. The work of setting, yeah. All you can do is like be angry at them for not following the boundaries. So don't introduce them something as they are, once they are thinking for themselves. You want to introduce them to things like video games and YouTube and social media when they're still young enough that they're going to listen to everything their parents say, when you can still control how many minutes they have, where you can help them build good habits around, you know, when my kids were probably, I don't know, from six to 10, I didn't allow any handheld screens after dinner at all. Like after dinner, we watched a movie and then they went to bed or something. Like they were allowed screens as a family, but nothing alone. And almost all of the video gaming from those young ages that they did, and they did a lot, but it was always with me or with their, or co-player with another kid. It was, which we all know is a good thing, right? If there's one thing we know as a fact, you know, this goes back to Sesame Street, that when they first did Sesame Street, they did all of this research to go, how can we minimize the negative parts of screens, and how can we maximize its potential as a teaching tool? And it became, and the research was totally conclusive then, which is what they called then co-viewing, which meant parents and kids watching together. That's why Sesame Street would always have like these jokes that were for the adults at the same time, right? You know, the Johnny Cash is playing with the Muppets, and the kids are like cute Muppets, and the parents are like, that's so funny that Johnny Cash just turned shot a man in Reno to something about a monster, right?
Mm-hmm. Right? Unlike Coco Melon, which I not much for the parents.
Right, exactly. And so the parents end up putting their kids in front of a TV babysitter, where Sesame Street, the parents would watch with the kids. Well, that's the same thing. You should be playing, again, not before three, but once they get older, yeah, you should be like, how about we play Angry Birds together? We'll take turns, right? Mm-hmm. We should play these things together. This is how they're going to start to learn social skills for a digital world, right? We know that all social skills are learned through play, right? Two kids are on the playground imagine two kids on the playground. They're trying to play whatever game they're playing, pirates or ponies, or I don't know what they're playing. They're running around the playground with some crazy imagination game. And they get into an argument. Well, what you learn when you're like 3 years old, probably even younger, is you go, wow, argument ruins fun. Let me try to not get an argument. Let me try strategies to keep the fun going. Right. And so that's how you start to learn social skills. You start to learn how to respond to other people's boundaries. You start to learn to set boundaries yourself, all those things that we need to be self-regulate your own behaviors, right? I'm not going to scream when they step on my foot. I'm going to just say, ow, I'm not going to hit them. I'm not going to bite them. I'm going to regulate my emotional response. This is all things we learn playing. Well, we're always playing with technology, right? But old technologies, playgrounds were invented in the early 20th century, sliding boards, sandboxes, all early 20th century ideas. In fact, prior to the early 20th century, most play was considered sinful. It was like idle time. Don't be idle. We need to get those kids to work in the fields fast before the devil gets them. So what it is very important to get those playground skills, but there's another kind of playground, and that's a digital playground. And that's where you start, you know, it's a different kind of skill set to be able to manage those things. That's why they need parents next to them starting to teach them that. The other thing I'll just say about a regular playground is when my kids were little, I used to take them to the playground, I don't know, almost daily, right? Almost every time it wasn't raining. We lived up the street from a playground at the time, and I would walk them there when I got home from work, and we would play for an hour, then we'd come back. Most of what I did at that playground was I went like this: don't bite, don't hit, share, be kind, don't hit, don't bite, share, be kind. Well, right now what we do with screens, because we don't give them to them till they're like hormonal teenagers, and then we're like, deal with it yourself. What we should be doing when they're 5 and 6 and 7 is going, do the digital equivalent of share, don't bite. Why do you think people are so terrible on Twitter? Their parents never taught them manners for the digital world.
Yeah. How do you like navigate the addictive nature of technology? Like a playground isn't as addictive as an iPad.
Well, that's questionable. So that depends on how
at
you look.
At least I don't think so.
So when we talk about addictive and it's problematic, you know, we should probably use a different language, because okay. It depends on whether you're talking about, addiction traditionally meant like chemical dependency. Now people are starting to use a different neurological definition. That's why I just sort of just avoid the word, because I'm not a doctor with enough to be able to make the distinctions. But the first thing I would say is, like, they're usually talking about the little dopamine hits that you get from, like, you know, the reward system that's built into a video game, for example, right? I mean, it's a small dopamine hit. Yeah, it's about the same as you would get from a hug or from eating a piece of pizza. So what we're trying to do right now is to go, hey, a product that has reward systems built into it, which is problematic in some ways, but that's, you know, a problem with capitalism, not a problem with technology. And I'm not saying I'm against capitalism either. I'm just saying, like, if you want to take up the reward system in for profit, then that's the location of it. It's not because it's a screen. But what we have to do is we have to teach the self-regulation skills. And that's why I think that parents need to do it sit next to their kids when they're little. And, you know, your kid when you're little will also eat chocolate cake all day if you don't teach them how to say no, if you don't teach them what those limits are. And in most cases, we don't do it. In most cases, we leave kids alone to be in their bedrooms with the door closed. And then we're like surprised that they've got unhealthy relationships with screens. Another thing I'll say, then, this is more to parents who have older kids, whether those are 7, 8 year olds or even teenagers. You know, we hear a lot about things like video game addiction. What has always concerned me about that is that chances are, if your child has developed an unhealthy escapist attitude to the screens and to the social media, that there are other problems that have led them to that. And when we scapegoat the social media for that, we don't look at those other problems, whether those problems are familial problems, whether those problems are anxiety problems, whether those problems have to do with body image.
What are they escaping? Right.
Yeah. And so many of the things we're terrified in social media. I mean, this one is another one that always, which now we'll tie the two books together, which is, you hear this all the time, the Instagram, like, oh, it creates this terrible ideal of the body that makes people lonely and depressed. Listen, body image issues and bullying based on gender has been going on. At least it was going on when I was a kid, but we're pretty sure it's been going on at least since the beginning of the 20th century. To suddenly pretend that it's gotten bad because we're aware of it is not okay, right? The screens have brought to the surface what was always there. Kids who were ready to commit suicide because they're bullied because they don't fit into normal gender categories, for example, right? Kids who are feeling unbelievable pressure to conform with social ideas about sex and consent and are consenting to things they don't really want to do because they're afraid that they think they're going to be uncool and unpopular if they don't say yes. Those things were all happening long before the internet, and we are actually starting to talk about those things. Again, don't blame the internet for those things. also, I'm not saying it's okay, just let your kids be on the internet all day. I'm saying we need to be parents who get involved and acknowledge these difficult challenges and struggles of what it means to be a child and help our kids through them. And I don't think those things have gotten harder. They've just gotten harder to ignore.
Well, with social media and Instagram, like, while I agree with you, those kinds of issues have been around forever. I think that there's now just a lot more of it and it's constantly in your face. I think that's part of the problem with social media. However, there are a lot of benefits because, like you said, people are talking about it. There's a lot of positive stuff that you can find where that normally before that you wouldn't have any resources to find any positive.
So there's an argument people make a lot, which is they go, you know, at least if you were the kid getting bullied in pre-social media, you could go home and you would get some respite from it. And you don't get that at home because of the screens. I mean, there is some truth to that, but we also do know that many kids who are bullied for whatever reason or have other problems, whether it's eating disorders, whether it's trans kids, whether it's homosexual kids, you know, whatever they are that would have gotten them bullied in the old days, they're now finding support online. We also have done studies where we know that when you ask kids questions about cyberbullying and in-person bullying, they still report a much higher rate of in-person bullying than cyberbullying. Most of them say they haven't experienced any cyberbullying. They almost all say they've experienced in-person bullying. Now, can we trust their self-reporting? I'm not trying to give that as a like last, you know, ditch report. I'm just saying that we have a lot of assumptions around these things that don't necessarily have good enough science for us to take those assumptions to be true. And we love to, you know, we like the things that we have confirmation bias, especially when it comes. I mean, this is something I'll change the subject for 1 second, but keep it slightly connected. Between the two books, I discovered like amazing things about confirmation bias, you know, where like when I would write things for major media things, right? Major media will take the worst study about screen time no matter how bad it is, and turn it into the scariest thing ever. It'll be like one kid reported that the internet caused them,
and they make the most alarmist titles.
Yeah. I tried to write some articles about like gender and how it shaped people. I won't mention the media outlet, but it's one of the biggest ones. They looked at the study that I cited and they complained that there were only 24 people in the test case. And I just went, the amount of things that you all have published with bad methodology, why is it you're not willing to, like, you're actually checking the methodology on gender studies, but you didn't check it on any of the screen studies? Because the screen studies keep our regular attitudes about screens in place, where when you try to break down ideas about gender, you know, people go, oh, I don't want to break that down. I don't want to think about that differently. I'm going to double check this study.
Right. Well, nuance doesn't get clicked.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
I wanted to talk about fatherhood again. What, just from the perspective of a father, like, what are some challenges in fatherhood that kind of no one really talks about, or you don't hear often said, maybe from the mother or the heteronormative mother situation.
You can imagine how hard it was to write. Sentence I had to think about those questions. And it's important. I'm glad I had to do that. Yeah, but it was hard. And that's what part of why I wrote the book was acknowledging how hard that is right now.
Yeah. So what are some challenges maybe that like, just let me say, I'm going to say mothers might not see or think of?
The first thing, I'm trying to think about how to frame this as a simple answer to your question, but I guess it's just going to get complicated. let's do it this way. I don't think we realize how difficult it is, how difficult the patriarchal expectations are for fathers. Okay. I say that, but I also want to say that with the caveat that I am not saying fathers are victims, because that would be absurd in patriarchy to say dads are victims. But I will say that there's a lot of there's a lot of difficulty in being a father. We have this image in our culture and in many cultures around the world of what some researchers call impossible masculinity. And what they mean by that is, you know, all the things we think of automatically when we like be a man, right? The like king of the hill, you're supposed to be the alpha. You're always supposed to be the strongest. You're supposed to be able to, you know, women are conquest and you need to have the fastest car and you need to be the toughest and all the, I don't have to keep going. Everybody knows that. It's impossible to achieve. Okay. It's impossible for everyone to achieve. Right. And just to make that point, right. You can't be the alpha in every part of your life, right? You have a boss, or maybe you're lucky enough to be an athletic superstar, right? Like an NBA player. You still have a coach and a manager and advertisers and people who are above you. Even if you're the president of the United States, and we had one who liked to imagine himself as an alpha, he's supposedly the strongest, most powerful man in the world, and still was like crying every time anyone made fun of him, right? Because he is constantly feeling like, how dare you don't give me the respect I need as a man, right? So all men are going through this experience of feeling that they are not achieving manliness. Every single man, whether they'll admit it to you or not, is constantly walking through their day going, oh my God, I'm failing to be the man that I'm supposed to be. I'm failing to be the man they've been telling me I'm supposed to be since I was 12 in the locker room, okay? I'm not as strong. There's someone stronger than me. In the worst case scenarios, those men come home and they look at the people who are weaker than them. And that's their chance to prove they're at least alpha somewhere in their own house. And in the worst case scenarios, that becomes real violent or sexual abuse. But in almost every other scenario, it still becomes problematic behaviors, right? So I don't want any men to be like, well, I don't ever hit anyone, so therefore I'm okay. No, you're not. You're still mansplaining, and you're mansplaining at home because you can't mansplain at work. Okay. Mm-hmm. And because you feel you're full of self-loathing all day because everyone's told you you're supposed to be something that's impossible to be. So you always feel like a failure. So you take it out on other people, and you do it by trying to prove your strength or by leading to depression or all of these things. And that's where we start to need to reproduce really bad ideas about what it means to be the so-called man of the house. That's where we start to do so many things that are problematic. I mean, there's a part in the book where I go into detail about where we get ideas like daddy issues, right? This idea, this strange idea we have about men, about dads and their daughters. It's this weird, erotic, subtly erotic idea that they're supposed to like, that's my little darling. She was married. I give her away at the wedding because now there's another man she loves, right? A dad's supposed to be like the prototypical boyfriend. And it's so weird and creepy when you look at it.
But isn't it Freudian?
It's actually post-Freudian. It came about in 1940s. Freud, no. Freud actually believes that the Oedipal all ended. I mean, I'm not defending Freud, but for Freud, the Oedipal stage is over by like five. Okay.
Oh, okay.
But what happened in the 1940s was after Freud was dead, all these other psychoanalysts, both men and women, started to say there was a second Oedipal phase only for women, right? In which they find their sexual development through their relationship with their father. And if they can't do it, that's when there's real problems, is if their father doesn't say the right things, right? If dad ignores you too much, you're going to have daddy issues, and you're always going to want men to treat you to compensate for that problem. And you're probably going to be promiscuous, right? We all know these ridiculous stereotypes, yeah. right? If you got too much attention, then no man's ever going to be good enough for you, right? So dad has to balance the entire sexual future of this. And by the way, it gets, I don't write about these details in the book, but it gets really creepy when you go into the history of this. There are doctors who thought it was better for a father and his daughter to actually consummate a sexual relationship than for there to be no relationship where the daughter didn't know the father.
What doctors? I don't want to read that.
Tons of them.
Really?
This was taken as the norm, was that like all your ability to be a healthy woman was all dependent on your relationship with your father. You can see it if you just think about some of the some famous plays, like, you know, Glass Menagerie. The like, here we have this frigid daughter who can't have any connections because the father is absent, right? Father Knows Best is another part where this erotic daddy daughter, also the Steve Martin version, but that's the later version. There was a much earlier version where it came first. I mean, that's really from the time when it all became normal. It used to be ads, so, you know, you should take your daughter shopping. You know, that was how you get to. I mean, I have a whole chapter about this in the book, and when I read it, it just totally freaked me out. I was like, this is crazy. My mom, for years, until my grandfather died, every year my grandfather would send her a box of chocolates shaped like a heart on Valentine's Day every year. And even as a little kid, I was like, isn't Valentine's Day about a different kind of love? I'm really confused. And there was nothing like, there's nothing bad. My grandfather was a great guy, but he had probably received so much media about this is how you raise a happy, healthy daughter, wow, that he was doing this weird thing, right? And many people still do it.
Yeah.
Well, the daddy daughter dance at the wedding? No, like, I that's know. Weird.
I still did it. So then how does, like, the, you know, the not being man enough and being the man of the house, how does that, you know, segue into being a father? Like, the how do you avoid that at home?
Yeah, well, what it means is you really need to understand, the way I put it in Father Figure is, you really need to understand that you are not the hero of the story. Okay, you're the hero of your own story. We're all the hero of our own stories, right? We all go through the world thinking like we're the protagonist, and we're, you know, I'm Luke Skywalker, and then I've had a kid, now I'm Darth Vader, right? you know, we all go through the world with all this idea that we're the lead character in our own story. What we forget is that everybody else is also going through it that way. So what happens a lot of times for dads, especially because all of the media is telling us that it's okay for us to do it to see it this way, and that we are the most important person in the story, is that we actually think we are. For a perfect example of this is, research has shown that most families end up living what's most convenient for the father's job. Even if the mother makes more money, they end up living in the place that's most convenient for the father's job, the same town as the father's job. Instead, you have to realize that every other person in your family is also the hero of their story, and you might be the villain. Sometimes you might be the mentor. Sometimes you might be the annoying sidekick sometimes, and you have to be willing to play whatever part you are.
Well, thank you so much for all of this, Jordan. Thanks for coming on the show. How can people, you know, pick up your book? I'm assuming it's available where books are sold, but,
I hope
share.
So.
Because people are looking, it's like, oh no, I can't find it. Can you share where people can follow you, find your books?
Yeah, absolutely. The book is called Father Figure: How to Be a Feminist Dad, and you can find it at any of the major bookstores. I like the indie bookstores. Most people like the indie bookstores these days, so I'd encourage that, but I won't be mad if you do another one. Bookshop.org is a great way to order, and that gives money to independent bookstores. Or if you want to just learn more about it or find lots of links to order, you can go to feministdadbook.com. Feministdadbook.com. Do you remember when, I don't know how old you are, when I was a kid, we still had answering machines. How about you?
I had answering machines.
Yeah. And you had to like say the number five times just to make sure. Can I say feministdad.com five times so no one has to rewind? Feminist? No. If you can't spell feministdadbook.com, then I don't know.
I don't know.
But actually, it's pretty easy. It'll come up in Google, feministdadbook.com. Yeah. You know, even if you spell it wrong, Google will fix that for you. And then you can follow me on any social media. It's at Jordosh, J-O-R-D-O-S-H, J-O-R-D-O-S-H. That's on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, not TikTok yet, because every time
I was gonna say TikTok,
every time I get excited to try TikTok, my kids are like, "Dad, please don't get on TikTok. That's so cringe. That's so cringe."
Ugh, they love to say that. And your first book, The New Childhood, Raising Kids to Thrive in a Connected World, is also.
That's right. You'll also find that at feministdadbook.com. Once you go to feministdadbook.com, you can find everything about me. You know, photos. I don't know.
Everything.
Everything.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on the show, being our first dad on the show. And everyone, please go read Father
Figure. Is there like a plaque or something? Did I get a plaque for being the first dad?
I'll send you an indie book gift card.
A certificate? Can I just get a certificate?
I'll draw something for you and mail it. Well, that is it for this episode of Betches Moms podcast. Do not forget, please, to rate, review, and follow us on Apple and Spotify. Follow Betches Moms on Instagram. You can follow me at Aileen. Follow Jordan at Jordosh. And remember, there are no rules in this podcast. I'm not like a regular mom. I'm a cool mom.
The Betches Moms podcast is produced by Sean Kilby and Jorge Morales Pico. Editing by Stacey Wong. Social media by Brittany Levine. Guest booking by Nicole Pellegrino. Be sure to follow us at Betches Moms on Instagram and send us your emails to moms@betches.com. Betches.